This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana. Robin Dow producing, and signature support is from Jerry Lane Chevrolet and First Financial Tax and Accounting Services. We start with Foster Campbell, the longtime Louisiana public official, 47 years and counting as a statewide official, and he's got several more years to go on his term with the Public Service Commission, first elected there in 2002. After being a member of the Louisiana Senate from 1975 until he left to join the PSC. And we're going to cover a few matters, but he came on this show to talk about Senate Bill 381. And for years, Foster Campbell has fought against the payday loan industry. Years ago, he was fighting pawn shops for interest rates that he felt were excessive and unfair. Well, last night, Governor John Bel Edwards, after receiving a letter from Commissioner Campbell asking him to veto Senate Bill 381. John Bel Edwards issued a statement last night and has actually provided the letter that he sent to the Senate President, Paige Cortez. It says, "Dear President Cortez, please be advised that I have vetoed Senate Bill 381. This bill is entitled the Louisiana Credit Access Loan Act. It purports to create additional loan opportunities for individuals who have difficulty obtaining loans through traditional banks. However, and despite the best efforts of the bill's author, Rick Ward, I do not believe that this bill adequately protects the public from predatory lending practices. I've long been opposed to payday loan products, which are designed to keep vulnerable individuals in debt, oftentimes paying exponentially higher rates of interest than would otherwise be available at commercial banks. While I would be willing to support and sign into law a bill that reforms payday loans in a manner that provides appropriate safeguards on interest rates and fees, this bill, unfortunately, does not meet that standard. Sincerely, John Bel Edwards, Governor." Foster Campbell, your thoughts?
Well, there's an old saying up here, there's no wrong way to do the right thing. He did the right thing. And he used a word in his letter, I'm looking at his letter, predatory. These are predatory rates. These people are predators. They prey on the poor, the people who need help. And what do? They put their foot on the back of their neck and try to extract every drop of blood out of them they can. And they come with a bill this year. It was incredible. And they used a 13% maintenance fee. What in the hell is a maintenance fee? All that is just more interest, 13% a month maintenance fee, and underwriting fee, $50 if it's over $400. Underwriting fee. In other words, someone comes in there, borrows your money. You want to just touch him up for another 50. We can call it an underwriting fee. You can call all these fees anything you want to. They're just raising interest rates. And one time when we was looking, you're not going to believe this, but it's the fact. One time we were looking at payday loan companies, and I found a payday loan company outside in Vernon Parish, outside of Fort Pope. We figured the interest is 400-500% a year. So, I mean, it's incredible. They bought 30 days and you pay double back. So when you figure all that interest, it's not 36%. It's 100%, 200%. And these people have the guts to come down there and want a maintenance fee. And then they want a underwriting fee. You can't fill these people up. But I want people, if you're listening out there, let's look at Louisiana a little bit. And this comes from Louisiana's budget project, how Louisiana ranks nationally. Second highest in poverty, second highest in child poverty. Let me read you these statistics. The share of children living in poverty in Louisiana increased slightly to 26.8%. That's one out of four in 2019 from 18, leaving 280,000 children to struggle, including 140,000 in deep poverty. And what's our solution? Well, I know what the solution is. Let's go let the payday loan companies suck a little more blood out of the people that they say have to have them to get along. Realizing some states have kicked these people out. Don't let them do business in this state. And here we are. We're feeling sorry for them, and they come up with some kind of what killed me was, listen to the name of this bill, the Louisiana Credit Access Loan Act. Give me a break. Louisiana Credit Access Loan break. Access loan. It is. It's an access for the people to put your foot on the back of people's head and say, hey, you got a few drops of blood left. I want that too. I want that too. And by the way, you live in the second poorest state in America. Don't worry about it. Don't worry about it. There's still a little blood in these folks down here, and we want to get every drop they've got in the second poorest state in America. This is a sinful thing that was introduced, sinful, and I'm glad he vetoed it. I voted for John Bel Edwards. I'm not sorry I voted for him. He absolutely did the right thing here. They ought to reform these payday loan companies and to make sure that they reduce, instead of increasing, they ought to reduce the rates they can charge. That's what ought to be happening in Louisiana. But we don't see anybody doing that because you can't get it through the legislature. How in the hell this thing got through the legislature, I don't know. I don't know. And it was sitting on the governor's desk, and I wrote him a letter, and we're friends. And I'm real glad when I all see right. him, and I tell him thank you because he did the right thing.
Now, of course, they could override his veto, but this did not pass with a veto-proof margin. The only Democrat in the Senate who voted for it was Gary Smith, who's being touted as a candidate for governor. And that is a bit curious, but he did vote for it. But it doesn't look like it has the mojo to get past the governor's veto. And the governor did leave open the possibility of tweaking the payday loan industry, but you'd like to just shut it down altogether, wouldn't you?
Yeah, I like a lot of other states. He used the right word, predator. These are just like, this is just like a hawk waking up on a high limb waiting for a rabbit to jump. That's all this is about. If you visualize a hawk up on high up in a tree, looking down to see if a rabbit will jump, and then where they can get something to eat. This is pitiful. It's pitiful. And the real tragedy here, people don't realize. They realize it. Mississippi and Louisiana, New Mexico, Alabama. Why do they come to these poor, poor states? Why don't they go to Connecticut? They don't want to have them up there. People make more money. We don't make the money. People have a harder time making a living in Louisiana. And our answer to that is let the payday loan companies raise their rates on the poor. I ain't no preacher, but the Bible is full of this stuff about Jesus running money changers out of the temple and about usury. Come on, man. Happy people down there want to preach all the time. It should have never got out of committee.
All right. Well, a listener, Foster Campbell, makes a good point in that the governor right now is handcuffed because Republicans have an overwhelming majority in both houses. But in a case like this, he probably is the difference between this becoming law and it not, because if a Republican were governor, my guess is that this bill would have been signed into law.
Well, that's a shame. That's a shame. People better wake up and realize who protects you now. Look, I'm a loyal Democrat. Everybody knows that. And I have some good Republican friends. But some Republicans voted against this bill. Not all. It never would have passed. It had some.
But it did pass.
I know.
Both
houses. I think most Republicans. But there are some Republicans who have voted against it. But the way these bills pass is they get through and nobody says anything about it. They just get, And I was warned about it, and I was glad, and I didn't know anything about it. This was going to slip right through the cracks. This is one of those sneak attack deals. Nobody says much about it, and it just gets through the cracks. And then all of a sudden, if this thing would get to be law, there's no way in the world you'd ever get it out. They know that. This is a sneaky, sneaky piece of legislation. And John Bel Edwards did the exactly right thing. He ought to veto the hell out of it. He did. Hopefully the legislature now would never override it. After publicity, people know about it. Surely they don't have the guts to try to override him on this.
All right.
He'll have the people with him on this. Absolutely.
Henry at the Country Club of Louisiana. Hello, Henry.
Morning, Mr. Jim. Morning, Commissioner. I have a question. I see that there's now going to be a fee that your other commissioners put on us to pay for Gulf States to rebuild after the storms. My question is this. Don't the stockholders carry any risk?
Boy, that's a great question.
We're segueing, go for it.
We just had hell last week. Sum this thing up real quick, and I'm not going to take all your time up, Mr. Easter, but there's four things that happen. When you have a storm, the storm happens. It's terrible. People out of electricity. Some people die. And we're having more and more in Louisiana. Then they report the damages to the Public Service Commission. And we have people that go out and make sure those damages are correct. Then they come back in and they ask us to pay for it, which last time they voted to pay for it. It wound up being $3.2 billion. This is energy we're talking about on five storms, $3.2 billion. Okay, when you get to thinking about it, they floated a bond issue, and the 1.2 million energy customers from Arkansas all the way to the Gulf of Mexico, they're the biggest in the state. They got 1.2 million.
Okay, we do have to take a 90-second pause, but we'll pick up with Foster Campbell in a minute and a half. Your number, 877-217-5757. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana. Emails to talk at talklouisiana.org and phone calls to 877-217-5757. We're visiting with Foster Campbell. We've got two topics on the table right now, and maybe one or two more in our remaining time with him, but please be brief in your comments. Miriam in Mandeville writes, only the Bible mentions Jesus ever being violent was over predatory lenders, yet all these good Christians eagerly support the payday lending industry. Governor John Bel Edwards has vetoed Senate Bill 381, which would expand payday loans in our state, and we have more payday loan centers, says Foster Campbell, than we do McDonald's in Louisiana. Big industry in our state. People, of course, here are lower income than most other states per capita, and these places provide, in some cases, a safety net, but in many, many cases, people end up having a vicious cycle of debt that they cannot get out from under, and it goes on and on and on and on, and they become repeat customers, and it's one payday loan after another at really high interest rates. That is one topic, and the other that you were expounding upon as we went to the break are some challenges, issues that you see with energy. Please continue, Foster Campbell.
Yeah, what I was telling you is that basically there's four steps. You have a big storm, they're terrible. People die, just like Katrina, 3,000 people died, all the damage, you know. Just like these five storms we've had, all of them, war, these, that, and the other ones. All right, so energy comes up with a $3.2 billion bill. They say that this is what this has cost energy, all these five storms, $3.2 billion. The Public Service Commission assigns some experts. We hire experts to go in to check their math and make sure they're right. Okay, they come back, and the Public Service Commission voted to give them $3.2 billion. They sell bonds on the market. The bonds are sold. With the guarantor is the people of Louisiana, the 1.1 ratepayers, they guarantee the bonds. And they were AAA bonds. So energy gets a big fat check 2 weeks ago for $3.2 billion. One time, $3.2 billion, they lay it on their desk. Say, hey, here's your money. So energy's not out one dime, not one red cent did they pay for a storm. The ratepayers pay it all. And what do they do for the ratepayers? Listen to this now. They say, well, we add up all this, and we're going to add about, it's going to be about $20 a month extra to your bill from Arkansas to the Gulf of Mexico. Now, if you're on energy, you can look to see about $20 on your bill every month for 15 years to pay for the storm. So I got to thinking about it. Well, energy gave their stockholders in 19 a $1.1 billion dividend. And they gave their stockholders in 20 a billion dollars and 21 a billion dollars. And they had the nerve to raise their president. He was making $16.5 million a year. They raised his salary up to $17.5 million in 1 year. Now, they're taking care of their stockholders and their employees. But what about the ratepayers? They
right.
say, well, we're going to let you pay $20 a month. So what I've asked to do, I want energy to put some money up. I want them to put 20%. They got another damage case coming up of $1.5 billion. So 10% of $1.5 billion would be about $200 million or something like that.
Really?
I want energy to put up $200 million to have some skin in the game. They don't have any now, and they ought to be paying for some of this.
All right. Well, a listener asked, would you advise people to go out and buy energy stock?
Well, their stock's done good. And realize this now, if people are buying stock, what do they usually do? They go to utility stocks because they always, you don't get rich, but you always get 4 or 5% on your money.
Yep, relatively safe when, investment, yeah.
Very safe. When CDs are paying half a point, utility stocks are great. And why shouldn't they be great? then they got a monopoly. Nobody can compete against them. They don't pay for any damages. Mm-hmm. And the irony of this guy, Mr. Denault, now, I asked him this last week in a meeting. Mr. Denault, is it true during this storm, Ida, that you and your family went up to your vacation home in Vail, Colorado for a week? And he told me yes. And I asked him, I said, did any bells go off in your head? Did anything ring up there or somebody saying, maybe I'll not be up here in Colorado with my family when everybody's in pure hell down in Louisiana and my company, maybe I ought to be down there passing out water or something or helping the people climb all those poles and trying to put the wire back together? But no, I took a corporate jet up to Colorado and vacationed for a week. I don't understand thinking like that.
All right.
I really don't. I just don't understand that, how a man running a company could even consider doing something that counts.
As we're speaking, I received an email from your former adversary, John Neely Kennedy. He says, in the 30 seconds it's taken you to read this short email, the left has raised thousands more. Help me catch up with them today. Chip in now, my friend. Here's a guy who has about $15 million in the bank ready to go. And the Democrats, of course, are fighting among themselves. What do you think?
Well, first thing I'd like to ask Mr. Kennedy. I would like to ask Mr. Kennedy, first of all, when does he get off of hee-haw, quit acting like he's on hee-haw, because it's all baloney. He never talks like that. Next thing I would ask him, who won the election? Will you admit that Mr. Trump lost, Mr. Kennedy? I'd like for you to do that. And would you admit maybe we need to do something about automatic rifles that are killed all those children down in Texas? Or would you look at anything that maybe stopped somebody from having a gun that'll shoot 30 times in a two seconds or whatever they do? Well, that's what I'd like to. Don't be worried about raising money. Why don't you take care of the business at hand, Mr. Kennedy? That's what he ought to be talking about.
877-217-5757, a bit more time with Public Service Commissioner Foster Campbell. And another listener, this is Holly in the Garden District, asking about congressional redistricting, and she asks a good question. Why is it a case in Louisiana with 5 PSC districts, 2 Democrats can get elected, but with 6 congressional districts, only 1 Democrat can be elected? Why is that the case, Foster Campbell?
I don't know. Maybe I'm lucky. I got elected last time, and you're right. In North Louisiana, which is supposed to be the most conservative part of the state, but I had a Republican opponent, and in 24 parishes, and I got elected. Maybe they like somebody that's speaking up for people that's active and on the people's side. I don't know, but you can do it as a Democrat. I'm living proof.
But it was a close race.
But it was close.
And the districts, of course, are drawn differently. The congressional districts all over the country, and I heard a report yesterday that in 2002, Foster Campbell, there were 124 U.S. House districts settled by fewer than 5%. That dropped to 99 in 2012, and this year it's expected to be 30. 30 out of 435. The districts are drawn to protect the incumbents.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I have one solution that would do more for Congress than anything that I think. I think that we ought to ask the congressman, you could never get this passed. This would be the best reform bill in the United States of America. What you need to do is ask, you pass a bill to say that if you're lucky enough to go to Congress or you're in the United States Senate, you're going to serve out your term and you won't go back and be a lobbyist. You think about every one of our congressmen, almost to the person. They're back in Washington lobbying for big $200,000, $300,000, $500,000
a
year
about that.
For the special interest.
But not our dear friend Buddy Romer.
No, he's
he did not do that. Patrick in Innisfil.
No, he didn't.
No, he didn't.
He did not do that. I give him credit. And Jerry Huckabee's not doing it, by the way. Jerry Huckabee lives in Ruston, and he is not doing that. Right.
Good man. Patrick.
That's the only two I know about.
I know. Patrick in Innisfil Estates. Hi, Patrick.
Hey, I have a quick question, since this is all in the news about abortion and mass shootings. Since you're a Democrat, do you support abortion? And what do you think, what kills more children a year, abortion or mass shootings?
All right.
I'd be glad to answer that.
Go ahead. Go ahead.
First of all, I have six children. Six. And so I didn't support any abortions. And my wife had a miscarriage, so I should have had seven. But anyway, other than that, when I was in the legislature, I voted for some exceptions. And I think it's insane not to have exceptions for health of the mother. I think if it's a woman's health involved, that ought to be between her and her family and the doctor. Incest for sure. Rape for sure. I also had a bill.
All right, hold tight. We're going to pick up with that. We'll spend a few more minutes with Foster Campbell, and then we'll visit with Shabir Safdar of the Partnership for Safe Medicines. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana. Robin Dow is producing. First Financial Tax and Accounting Services and Jerry Lane Chevrolet provides signature support. And Foster Campbell is with us for a few more moments, and then we'll turn the page and some fascinating news and actually troubling news from a group that follows medicines in our country, the Partnership for Safe Medicines. We'll visit with the Executive Director, Shabir Safdar, in just a moment. But Foster Campbell, I remember in 1990, Woody Jenkins had a bill to ban all abortions in Louisiana, and it passed the House and passed the Senate, and Governor vetoed it. And then there was an attempt to override the veto, and it fell three votes short in the Senate. And it was primarily because of three senators in North Louisiana who held their ground and wanted exceptions for rape, incest, and life of the mother. And Foster Campbell, along with, if I remember right, Lawson Swearingen and Senator Crane.
Don Kelly.
Was it Kelly? Okay. Don Kelly.
Yeah,
Kelly.
Okay. Yeah.
I think Crane as well. So four senators from North Louisiana made it impossible to override the governor's veto on that bill. But this trigger law that Kathleen Blanco signed in 2006, which will go into effect if and when the Supreme Court bans abortion in America, but state by state, it means no exceptions, none, except for life of the mother. Now, you're saying that's not particularly a good way to go. Am I following you correctly?
Absolutely. I could never support that if a woman's pregnant and they know that this child is going to cause damage. Knows it's going to cause damage. That ought to be between her and her doctor and her family. And that's crazy. And certainly with incest. You know, you got to have something. I was, before we went to break, at that time, there was a big scare with AIDS. Do you remember that?
Of course.
And at that time, I offered an amendment to say if a woman had AIDS, she ought to have the right to make that decision, because we thought that at that time, we thought that AIDS was passed on to the child if the lady was pregnant. I thought she's dying with AIDS, and she ought to have a right to do that. But it didn't pass. But you know the irony, you're talking about that? Guess who wrote a letter to Governor Romer to tell him to veto it? John Kennedy, Mr. Right to Life himself.
I know.
He wrote a letter to Buddy Romer asking him to veto that bill. Mr. Hehaw, Right to Life John Kennedy. He don't tell people about that when he tells them I'm all for Right to Life, but he's the guy that wrote the letter to Buddy Romer to tell him to veto the bill. Unbelievable. Mr. Hehaw incredible.
I have a feeling that Senator Kennedy will win re-election, and then he might very well run for governor, and we'll see. But Foster Campbell, I'm glad you're out there so we can follow the world scene with you. It's an interesting world, sometimes far too interesting, we live in. But thank you.
Well, thank you for calling me, and just remember what they say in North Louisiana, what some people say. There ain't no wrong way to do the right thing.
There you go. Foster Campbell, keep
going.
All right,
see you later. Thank you.
See you soon. The pride of Elm Grove, Louisiana. Now we're joined by Shabir Safdar, Executive Director for the Partnership for Safe Medicines. Now, this group is looking at what's going on, and fentanyl, as we know, has become a bigger killer than homicides or suicides. In fact, more Americans are dying from fentanyl overdoses than there are abortions in this country. But it's not just heroin. It's other pills that could be in play here. And Safter, you believe that, Sabir Safter, you believe that this includes counterfeit pills. How so?
Well, predominantly, you know, what we're seeing is the opioid crisis has transformed from a crisis of people who are struggling with access to legitimate painkillers like Percocets and oxycodone to people who are being victimized by fake pills. In fact, if you get from a friend who didn't get it from a pharmacy any kind of painkiller right now, Percocet, oxycodone, et cetera, you're probably getting a fake pill. It's just it's the predominant thing that's out there that is available and is killing people.
How are these being laced with fentanyl?
So it turns out that fentanyl is really cheap to make. You know, you can get a kilo of it for about $5,000, and you only need about a milligram to actually make you high. And so, you know, one $5,000 kilogram of fentanyl can be turned into about $20 million worth of product. And so the cartels that make fake pills, which is predominantly the source of fake pills in this country right now, love fentanyl. There's actually no other ingredient in it besides filler material. It's just filler material and fentanyl. And increasingly, it's too much fentanyl for any human to survive. So there are these pills that, you know, you're not addicted to them. You just take one that's got too much fentanyl, like 2 milligrams, and you will fall over dead.
And why would somebody lace a drug that is not designed to get somebody high? Why would they lace it with something lethal like this?
Well, fentanyl is actually an opioid. It's a synthetic opioid, so it mimics the behavior of painkillers and heroin. And so, you know, it's a lot cheaper to make a painkiller that feels like an opioid of fentanyl than it is of anything else. As far as why they would make it with a fatal amount, well, they're not very good at making pills, right? Quality control is challenging and difficult. And when you're a Mexican cartel and you're really not afraid of being prosecuted because you'll never set foot in the U.S., it doesn't really matter to you how many people you kill. And before you say, oh, that must kill all the customers, they won't make any money, the truth is that there seems to be an infinite supply of customers. If you are someone who's addicted and you're trying to forestall withdrawal feelings, which have been described to me as one of the most miserable feelings in the world, one of the weird things that happens is if you hear about people dying from fake pills, you'll often gravitate towards those dealers to get more of it because you really need to have product that's strong enough to keep those cravings at bay.
Well, nearly 108,000 Americans died from drug overdoses last year. That's the highest annual death toll on record. That's from the Centers for Disease Control. And our guest, Sabir Safter of the group that follows this, he's executive director of the Partnership for Safe Medicine, says counterfeit prescription drugs laced with fentanyl are contributing to this rise. And you also say there's a role that social media and online sales are playing in facilitating access to these pills. How is that happening?
So it turns out that social media is pretty bad at keeping crime off their platforms. And so drug traffickers have moved to social media because of its easy and cheap way to reach customers. And so we've been tracking for about 4 years the dangers of people setting up shop as drug traffickers on social media and then reaching customers. And we found that in 19 different states, individuals have met their drug trafficker on social media, bought a pill, and then died. And that's the 19 we know about. There's certainly states where it's happened that it's not completed. But to answer the question I know you have next, yes, Louisiana is one of those 19 states.
And Congress is involved in this, but you say not necessarily in a good way. Why?
So we spent the last 2 years watching global counterfeiters do what they've been doing for a long time, which is sending us fake medical products. The number of fake N95 masks, fake surgical gloves, fake COVID tests that counterfeiters around the world tried to get into the U.S. market is legion. And while Customs and Border Protection was often good at catching them en route into the U.S., it's very difficult to bring those people to justice. But those are the very same people that people in Congress want to bring into our drug supply through programs like Canadian drug importation. Sounds good, right? Canadians are friendly. They must have safe drugs. It's cheaper. But the truth is, there's a lot of these sketchy vendors who set up shop in Canada and then sell Americans drugs from other places. So, for example, in 2008, we saw a ring in Canada called Canada Drugs sell counterfeit cancer medication to doctors in the U.S. And those medicines went to patients. And, you know, a fake cancer medication is a death sentence. If you need the cancer medication to kill your cancer, you need the real thing. So we need, you know, I spent a lot of time talking to Congress and congressional staff trying to explain to them that this isn't the answer. What we really need to do is look at the problems within our own drug supply chain, like pharmacy benefit managers.
Well, thank you for joining us. Shabir Saftar, Executive Director, Partnership for Safe Medicines, one of the most important issues of our day. Appreciate your time and your insights, sir. Thank you.
Thank you for your time.
We're joined now by Trip Mickle. He has a book that is the talk of the town and whatever town we're in. Nice review in the New York Times Sunday. After Steve, How Apple Became a Trillion-Dollar Company and Lost Its Soul. Trip is a technology and corporate reporter for the Wall Street Journal. And in addition to writing about Apple for 5 years, he's written extensively about Google and other Silicon Valley giants. He's appeared on many programs of this kind. And his book in the New York Times Sunday starts with this review. Between 2001 and 2010, Apple launched the iPod, the iPhone, the MacBook Air, and the iPad. Each redefined its product category. Of these, the iPhone was the most important. Its obvious superiority forced every other company selling expensive phones to copy Apple's design or collapse. And so it happened at the time when Steve Jobs, the founder of Apple, was ailing, ultimately died, and he turned the keys of the kingdom over to others who have done a good job as far as stock value up until late. But you believe that there's some issues that are worth scouring, and that's exactly what you've done in After Steve. And good morning to you, Trip Mickle.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, we're about to go to a break, but quickly, Tim Cook, is he doing a good job?
You know, there are two scoreboards you can judge Apple by. One is the one that is kept by Wall Street, and by that measure, Apple's doing a tremendous job. The other is the one that a lot of enthusiasts of the company have measured the company by for a long time, and that's how many revolutionary new products it's launched. And
we're going to pick up with Trip Mickle right after this quick pause on Talk Louisiana. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. We're visiting with Trip Mickle. His book is After Steve, How Apple Became a Trillion-Dollar Company and Lost Its Soul. Apple currently trading at $149.5. Its high for the year, 52-week high, was $183. So it's come back to the pack, as most other stocks have, but it's worth its market capital, $2.42 trillion. So it is the richest company in the world, based on stock value. But Tim Cook took over after Steve Jobs died. And Steve, as Trip points out in his book, he got some instructions from the founder on his deathbed, didn't he?
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that Steve Jobs was really concerned about more than anything was Apple's survival. And he studied several companies, including Sony, Polaroid, and most importantly, Walt Disney's empire, to determine what could be done to make sure that the company had some longevity after its co-founder died. And he told Tim Cook, hey, look, you know, there's going to be an expectation and a temptation to say, what would Steve Jobs do in making any decision? And I want you to avoid that. I want you to do what's right. Don't ask what I would do. Do what's right. And that became kind of, I don't know, very freeing for Tim Cook. It allowed him to focus on what his strengths were and try to do the best job he could. And it's been key to unlocking a lot of value for the company.
And in the U.S., we hear a lot about Cook, who's leading the company, but there is this British-born designer savant who you profile, who He's as big of a player, if not as big or more so than Mr. Cook. Tell us more about this guy.
Right. The book's really a study of two figures, the top two lieutenants to Steve Jobs, and that's Tim Cook being the one we just spoke about. And then the other is Johnny Ive. Tim Cook is someone you can consider Apple's left brain leader. He's very skilled at operations. He's the one who transforms Apple's manufacturing capabilities and set up operations in China that really, really made it possible to manufacture 200 million iPhones a year, which is astounding. Johnny Ive is the right-brained figure at Apple. He's really the creative mind. He's the individual who helped come up with everything from the candy-colored iMac to the heavy stainless steel backing on the iPod to the rounded corners on the iPhone. All of these like aesthetic sensibilities that make Apple's products so compelling that you don't really think a lot about, but really influence and drive people's understanding of the product. That's all been directed by Johnny Ive for the better part of 2.5 decades.
Well, you note that Ive and Cook, of course, inherited this empire, and the iPhone is what revolutionized communication as we know it. I've got one in my hand as we speak. And it's true that after Jobs died, Apple didn't produce another device as important as the iPhone, but Apple didn't produce another device as important before he died either. So is that an unfair barometer to measure Ive and Cook by the iPhone?
Look, the iPhone is the best-selling product in history. So it's more than likely impossible to duplicate that feat. There was nothing to your point beforehand. But I don't know that the iPhone itself is the only barometer that you would judge these gentlemen on. In the run-up to the development of the iPhone, you had two influential products that really had huge cultural influence, and those were the candy-colored iMac, which really changed the way people think about computers. I mean, all of a sudden, in the wake of those computers, people began to see computers as kind of fun again. You know, they just for a long time they'd just been workhorses and the things that we use to do our jobs, and that injected a bit of vibrancy into the computer landscape. Yeah, I mean, it was so compelling. In fact, that you know there was that famous scene in Zoolander where they were jumping up and down and punching the top of the computer and saying the files are inside the computer. How do we get them out? And then later they developed the iPod, which was such a cultural sensation that you couldn't ride public transportation anywhere in the world without seeing people with white headphones dangling out of their ears because they were taking 1,000 songs on the road with them. It changed the way we listen to music and purchase music and everything else. I mean, so that was all before the iPhone, which is, of course, an indispensable part of our life. And it underscores what the collective group was able to do with Steve Jobs at the helm in terms of cultural influence and revolutionary product together.
The book is After Steve, How Apple Became a Trillion-Dollar Company and Lost Its Soul, from Trip Mickle, who has nuggets unearthed nowhere but in his book. James Stewart, pretty good author about these matters himself, says it penetrates the veil of secrecy shrouding one of the great dramas of modern business history, how Apple not only survived but thrived after the death of its brilliant, charismatic founder. Now, I remember when Walter Isaacson wrote his book about Steve Jobs after he died. He was on this show, and he was talking about the quirks of Steve. Here was the richest man in the world who declined to buy a $400 dress for his girlfriend, Joan Baez, at the time. He was a quirky fellow, but Cook is also, he's got an interesting backstory that many are unaware of, but you go into it. He's a fascinating man, isn't he?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's something that will certainly resonate with your listeners and resonated with me because I'm also a Southerner as well, is that he's from a small town called Robertsdale, Alabama, that's about an hour outside of Mobile. And it's really remarkable that someone from a place like that would rise to the heights of business and lead the world's largest company. And a company as well with such a, like a distinct California personality and ethos, right? It's really about, it's really about innovation and big thinking and so on and so forth. And that's, you know, I mean, that's not something that you often get and hear from being associated with companies that have been born out of the South. You know, that's not what you think of when you think of Coca-Cola, for example.
Well, he's also a guy who came out in 2014. That at the time, that was, of course, before the decision to legalize same-sex marriage by the Supreme Court. It was a brave move, wasn't it?
It was a brave move, but one of the interesting things that the book details is how deliberate and calculating that move was. Tim Cook was very aware of the fact that he was being scrutinized by people, by investors, by Apple enthusiasts, and questioned whether or not he could lead the company forward. And so he deliberately chose not to come out before feeling like he'd put the company in a good position to go to I guess persevere after Jobs, because he didn't want to set back other LGBTQ individuals who may be executives. He didn't want, you know, it to be Tim Cook failed at Apple and also Tim Cook, the first, you know, openly gay CEO, failed in leading Apple. He thought that would potentially set back others. And so he made sure that when he did it, the company was on the precipice of launching the iPhone 6, which is one of its best-selling iPhones. It really, shot sales really skyward. And he made the announcement then.
Tripp Mickles, a graduate of Wake Forest University, and a listener who knows your backstory, you started in sports, didn't you?
Yeah. In fact, I was listening to the commercial beforehand about LSU, and I was like, man, I would almost rather talk about the Tigers and Brian Kelly than Apple. But yeah, no, I was an aspiring sports writer, and I started in sports and transitioned to business in part because I feel like there's a little more depth and texture sometimes to writing about business than there can be to just everyday game coverage and game analysis.
Yeah, I'm with you. It's what Howard Cosell called dugout vision, and life is more than the games, but it's all about numbers. And it's about, when you're covering sports, it's about numbers, and when you're covering Apple, it's about numbers. But where does Apple go from here? What do you think?
You know, it's interesting. They're on the cusp of releasing some new products, according to reports, that will be will really dictate where it goes from here. They've been working on an augmented reality headset that Bloomberg has reported will be priced at about $3,000 and should be introduced a year from now. It's going to be an interesting product because so far the world has not shown a tremendous appetite for augmented reality. Facebook's been making a push of its own in that arena. It's had the Oculus product out for some time, and that's not really been embraced. But Apple does have that history of coming into a category that's already been established and introducing a product that is so much superior to anything else out there that people really do rush out and get it. That did not prove to be the case immediately with the Apple Watch, but over time it has gained momentum, and we'll see if they can do the same with an augmented reality headset.
The book from Tripp Mickle is After Steve, How Apple Became a $1 trillion Company and Lost Its Soul. It's now $2.5 trillion and still going. And as you heard from Tripp, it's got places that we'll see how it goes. But Tripp, thanks. Good job.
Thanks so much for having me.
My pleasure. Congratulations. First Financial Tax and Accounting Service and Jerry Lane Chevrolet provide signature support for our program. Back tomorrow. Stay safe and stay tuned.